Good morning, everyone, or afternoon or evening, wherever you are around the world. My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. I have had the gift of sobriety since December the 27th of 1972. So if I don't blow it, coming up on 50 years, just after Christmas. And my advice is take good care of yourselves, guys. You just don't know how long you're going to last. So I want to start by thanking the group who put this wonderful program together for the invitation to be a part of it. I'm really honored. Mike, I didn't know him real personally. We met through Zoom, and I had done my last workshop on two-way prayer over in Louisiana. And one of the women, after, you know, once we went into lockdown and all that sort of stuff, she said, well, you should get in touch with this guy, you know, and think about doing a workshop on Zoom. I didn't know about Zoom, and I'm an introvert. I was kind of terrified at anything new is always a threat and a challenge. So, we did it, and God bless him. I think he's responsible for getting that message that I had received from an AA archivist out to so many people all around the world. And I don't know how many we did, you know, maybe 20 over the years, but he always listened. He was always there in his office, but he wasn't tuned out. He was tuned in, and I could feel that. And I've just had that gift. You know, there's a lot of jerks in AA. Let's just be honest, you know. But there are some, you know, we are not saints, but there are some saints. There are some people out there who you can look in their eyes and you know, this guy or this gal, they have it. They have what I want. And I'm willing to go and get it. And so I thank him. He's one of my teachers. So for that, I'm very grateful. Also want to thank David for a wonderful talk. It's always after something like that. So, oh, let's all go home. You know, he said it all. I don't talk often about my, I mean, I do talks, but I don't share my story often. And I think in AA, that's the way I was taught, that you should do that. That you should tell what it was like, what happened. And I don't think we talk about what happened enough and then what it's like now. So I'm going to attempt to do that. And my story starts out, my God, there's a lot of Irish Catholics who've shown up over these 24 hours. I don't know where, must be an explanation for that somewhere. Anyway, I'm one of those. I grew up in an alcoholic family. Every male member, true story, every male member was an alcoholic, and half of the women were alcoholics, you know, and we had just enough Al-Anons to kind of, without program, to kind of keep the system moving forward or downward. I'm not downward, I suspect it was. And first drink at 12, I won a bottle of wine at a church bazaar. That's how I knew I had a vocation, David. You know, it came early. And I drank that wine. A couple of guys went behind the garage and downed it. And it was like, where have you been hiding this all my life? Because it took me to a place that I did not know and I wanted to return to. I barfed my guts out, you know, but that didn't matter. It was a spiritual experience of a perverted nature, but it was. It opened that doorway that had been closed. So I believe I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. I never really drank successfully. I mean, I remember at 16, we'd get terribly drunk and I'd start howling like a wolf. I mean, a total personality change. And I had a friend, he got drunk with me, but he said, you know, hey, Bill, there are people who shouldn't drink. And there are people who shouldn't even think about drinking. And then there's you, you know? And that son of a gun is jealous, you know, because I could put it away. I mean, I could drink a lot. I could drink a lot. Not going to do a long drunk log, but, you know, I used to work summers at a hotel in Rockaway Beach. We had a Rockaway Beach speaker earlier yesterday, and worked at that hotel. And then when I turned 18, I graduated to being the bartender there. And whoa, off I went. There was, you know, like David, there was that part of me, and this may be one of the things that is somewhat distinctive of many of us, that there was a spiritual part of me that always wanted to be right, to be good, to be in right relationship with God. You know, I was an altar boy at an early age. When other kids were out playing football, I was playing mass. I mean, I'm very sick when it comes to my pathology, religious wise, you know? So I'm balancing these two. Is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, like was being said. And when Mr. Hyde came out, it was a total personality change. I'm an introvert. I don't really like public speaking and that sort of thing. I was in Rome. I did a year study in Rome many years ago. I got drunk. And on the Spanish Steps, my roommate and I had a sword fight, an imitation sword fight. And then I led 500 people in a sing-along. You know, I could never do that sober. Never in a million years. But drunk, the doorway was open and God only knew who was going to come out. My drinking led me to be very much into the geographical cure. And I would do work until I got in trouble enough through the drinking that I had to move on to the next thing. And, you know, there's a, what does the book say? You know, it's a spiritual, I'll give you my version of this, what I was living at the time. It's a spiritual axiom that anytime I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with the people around me. And so I would change the people around me and go get a whole new set of characters until my drinking would catch up with me one more time. I taught history in New York City. And being an insecure alcoholic, I asked the students to evaluate me, and I was sharing that with the other teachers, how you know, I'm so insecure, I got to tell you how good I am. Share the good stuff with them. I hit this one note, dear Mr. Wigmore, I think you're a wonderful teacher. I wish you didn't drink so much. Now, a 15-year-old girl gave me my first real official diagnosis. So I would go from job to job doing things that looked good. That was very important to me, that they look good. So was in the Peace Corps in West Africa, but I'm drinking palm wine and diamond gin, 35 cents a quart or something. It took it out of radiators. It was awful stuff. I'm still a little brain damage from that. But drunk and in trouble. This is my formula. Drunk and in trouble. I was in Israel working on a kibbutz, drunk and in trouble. I was in the Catholic worker movement. I was kind of your radical back in the 60s. Drunk and in trouble, Catholic worker. I was supposed to be helping alcoholics, families, taking them in. But once they were in, I'm checking out. I'm in my relationship, my primary relationship with alcohol. Worked with orphan kids in the Bronx, same damn thing. Got in trouble. I was looking for a place. I was looking for a place. I'm starting to see the pattern where I could be taken care of for the rest of my life, look good, and drink. So I entered the Jesuit seminary. And if you think about it, it was actually a very good choice. You know, outwardly, I'm gonna look like I'm doing God's will and being this good guy and all this sort of stuff. But inwardly, I'm set up for some very fine scotch for the rest of my life, you know? And you're not gonna get to know me. You know, I'm not gonna really do life. I'm gonna look like I'm doing life, but not doing it. And that went way back to my alcoholic upbringing. My father was a violent alcoholic. He used to beat the hell out of me. I hated him with a passion. There was an inner rager in me I had to kind of keep the lid on that. And I remember when I was, I guess I was about 8 or 10 years old, something like that, living in New York City, living up on the fourth floor of an apartment house. And my father gets drunk and he's tearing up the furniture, breaking up the furniture in the house, violent. And my mother takes me and my two sisters down in the street. People are walking by, looking up, listening. You couldn't miss the noise. And I was so ashamed and so hateful. And I said internally, I had a potty mouth even as a kid, you know, but it was, you know, you son of a bitch, you're never going to hurt me again. And I think I put the last brick in the wall around my soul that was going to keep him out. But what I didn't know is it kept everybody else out also. And it kept me stuck in. And I'm stuck in there. And that's why alcohol was so wonderful, because it was my only friend in an unsafe and unfriendly world until it turned against me. And how that happened, I'm in the Jesuits. I'm starting, well, I think part of the Jesuit story is early. I volunteered. I'm in Detroit. I volunteered at an alcohol and drug treatment center. All the other guys, I was a little older than most of the guys in the thing. They're all doing this holy stuff. And I kind of knew inside, I'm not that holy, you know? So I find this alcohol treatment center that's run by a Catholic priest. And there's 183 alcoholics in an abandoned schoolhouse in Detroit. But it was the most marvelous healing place I'd ever walked into. And they had some of the best counselors there who were working for dirt. But it was like, this was the real thing. And so I walked in there and I said, well, I want to help. I want to volunteer. Thank God they were smart enough to say, well, you need to go through treatment if you're going to volunteer here. And the treatment was 17 weeks long. And I went through group therapy and lectures and all that sort of stuff. And I must have done very well, because at the end they said, we want you to do it again. Might have missed a few things. And at the end of that, they're pumping away at me. But I'm learning a few things. I was learning a few things. I'm not a total idiot. Well, there's my father. There's my Uncle Billy. There's Uncle Jimmy. There's all these people. And I'm in group and they're saying, no, Bill, there's you. There's you. And I'm saying, oh, no, get away. I fought it. Every good alcoholic must put up a fight, you know? So I put up my fight, but then they got to me and I started going to meetings. I went for about 3 months. And then I went out to California. I was kind of interested in the psychology thing. You know, it was like, whoo, there's another world in here, isn't there? A world I never knew about. They never taught me about that world, you know? But it's in there. And I want to find out more. So I'm a pretty good manipulator. So I manipulated them into saying, I want to go out and study under Carl Rogers, pretty famous psychologist. And he had a 3-week seminar out in California. And I said, well, let me go. And they said, well, that's kind of expensive. I said, well, I'll do a pilgrimage. I'll make this a pilgrimage. And I hitchhiked, took no money with me, and stayed at monasteries along the route. And Was doing pretty good. Although in Missouri, where Mike was from, I did stay at a place where they were making jelly and it had alcohol in it. And I ate a lot of jelly there. By the time I got to Arizona, the guy picks me up and he's got a six pack of beer in the car. He says, "Do you want a beer?" And I said, "Sure." I didn't think. It was like, sure, this is who I am. And so I started drinking. I didn't get a hell of a lot out of the seminar because it continued, you know. They sent me then to, I'm starting to get in trouble with the Jesuits. They're starting to catch on to me. I remember I would always line myself up. We had mass every day and I would line myself up to be the last in line. Now, not because I was humble. It was because I got to drain the cup, you know? And one of the old priests called me aside and he said one day, Bill, I can't help but notice that your devotion to the blood of Christ far, far exceeds your devotion to the body of Christ. Oh, see, they're catching on. They're catching on, you know? Time to start thinking of where to go. At that time, I had been assigned to Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. I'm supposed to be helping the chaplain there at the Newman Center. And I'm getting drunk and I'm stealing gallons of wine. I'm hanging around with people you shouldn't be hanging around with. I'm getting ready, theoretically, to take vows of, chastity, obedience, and celibacy. I figured I had a shot at poverty. Celibacy and obedience were not about to happen for me. And we won't go into that part of the story. But here's what's going on in my sick head, all right? I'm a runner. And I'm split on these two parts that David was talking about, all right? And part of me said, okay, where to now? Go to Australia and stay drunk for the rest of your life. And part of me said, go to India and join an ashram and get holy. And it was terrifying, you know? And Jesuits didn't know what the hell to do with me. I went back to the people at that treatment center and I kind of turned myself in and they sort of laughed and they had been waiting for me. And I went to a counselor, a sponsor guy, who said, listen, you're 27, you're not at a physical bottom. You can probably drink for 10 more years, but you are at a spiritual bottom and you're not going to make 10 years. And I knew he was right. I knew what he was telling me was exactly right. See, that's the thing about these people in AA. We can spot one another, you know, and we know that inner map of what's happening inside there that the earth people do not know about, you know? So he said, are you willing to go to any length to get sober? And I was desperate at that moment. 3 days before, probably not. 3 days afterwards, probably not. At that moment, I was desperate. Are you willing to go to any length to get sober? I said, yes. He said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go and live on Skid Row for 1 year. I want you to check into the Salvation Army. And I want you to look into the eyes of every alcoholic and addict that you meet. And I want you to say, there but for the grace of God goes I. He said, if you can make that identification, which is critical, it's absolutely critical. If you can make that level of identification, I think you'll stay sober. If you can't, you'll miss the mark. And I've never sent anybody, I've never had the guts to send anybody else on that journey. But I did it. I went to the Salvation Army. I checked in, you know. I said, well, where you been living? I said, well, at St. Francis House. He said, was that kind of like a halfway house? Well, yes, you might say that. So they took me in, and I worked spot labor jobs every day. It wasn't an inpatient program. It was like a hotel where you stay and you worked spot labor jobs. And I went to meetings. I went to meetings every day. I went to meetings on the weekends three times, you know. I moved from there after 6 months to an AA halfway house. We got married, three kids, wonderful. I began growing up. I after a year, they actually hired me at that treatment center and did a special counselor training program, went deeper and deeper into understanding addiction, and I loved it. What I want to say is what happened to me on the spiritual religious end that David was addressing. I had a really hard time balancing those two, you know, because part of me didn't believe some of the things that literally I thought they expected me to believe in. I didn't. And so I kind of adopted what I might call an AA amorphous God. God, whoever you are, I don't understand you, but I know I need you. And then I worked as a counselor, family therapist, all that good stuff. And I continued my AA. But at 20 years sober, so I'm gonna fast forward quite a, it's the problem with being around so long. But at 20 years sober, I knew I needed more. I knew the AA, as I had been working it, was not going to sustain me sufficiently. I could do it, but it wasn't enough. Something was missing. And that's when, and I won't go through the whole detail, but what happened to me is I met an AA archivist in Oklahoma City. His name was Earl Husband. And I went to an AA meeting there in Oklahoma City. And someone said, well, you know, I kind of told him what's going on with me. And they said, well, you need to go see old Earl. And I follow up on some instructions like that. I went and I saw old Earl. And old Earl spent 3 hours with me. I never met the man again in my life. Never. Never communicated with him again in my life. But he introduced me to the original program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the program that a lot of it was quite similar to what I had worked. And I had some pretty damn good teachers. There's no question about it. But he introduced me to the program as it was lived and worked before the big book was written. The program that Dr. Bob experienced, the program that Bill Wilson experienced, and Ebby and Roland Hazard, and all of those guys experienced, you know? Wilson called it the flying blind. Well, it wasn't that blind. I mean, while there were not steps, there was a program that led to transformation. And in the course of 3 hours, this guy basically took me through the steps in the original. I sometimes you'll hear a religious person say, well, you got to read this gospel in the Greek to understand it, you know? I don't know Greek. Well, it turns out I didn't know AA, or at least I didn't know Pioneer AA. I didn't know original AA. And that's what he took me through. So, like when we got to step three, he asked me, you know, have you done step three? And I said, well, I do step three every day. He said, well, no, they didn't do it every day. They did it one time. And they did it in the presence of another person. Have you ever done that? Well, I don't pray with people. I mean, I do a little serenity prayer and that kind of stuff. That's easy enough. But I mean, real prayer with another guy? No, I don't do that. He said, well, what would you be willing to do that? And he got on his knees. He went down first. And, you know, what are you going to do? Good manners, you know, you join them. So I'm on my knees. And he said, well, turn your life over to God. Because they did it. They did this third step in the presence of another person. I said, should I say the third step prayer? He said, I wish you wouldn't. Wish you wouldn't. David was talking about AA becoming mechanical, religion becoming mechanical. And he's spot on that the mechanical is not going to be sufficient if you're a real alcoholic, because you're looking for the essence. You're looking for God. You're looking for an experience. You're looking for that great reality. And you ain't going to settle for much less. So I got on my knees and I fumbled and bumbled, but I said the words and I felt something shift inside. Just like I had felt something shift in Cleveland when I knew the jig was up and I had to get serious and I couldn't run away. See, there's two things I knew about God's will for 20 years. For 20 years, I knew two things about God's will. One was, it is not God's will for me to drink. Crystal clear. No matter how manipulative, and I could never get beyond that. And the other thing I knew was, it's not God's will for me to run. Those were the only two things I knew. Don't drink, don't run. In other words, stay long enough for this thing to happen. And I was on a very slow path of transformation. Still am on that path of transformation. I'm not done yet. Robert Johnson, one of my teachers, a Jungian therapist. Yeah, see, David's coming alive there. Yeah. Robert Johnson talks about when his ego gets out of whack, he is sent back to this boiling pot in the oil of transformation. It's a lovely image. And that's been my story. You know, when my ego gets out of whack, when it starts to inflate, and it can inflate in a big way, or it can inflate in a small way, that I'm nothing. See, that's ego too. It's just I'm the worst piece of slime that ever crawled out from under a rock. That's ego. That's ego manifesting in the negative. You know, you're not that. So further boiling in the oil of transformation. What I did was I left that guy's house with a stack of books. He was a very generous man. And he gave me a stack of books on the Oxford group. And I read, I don't think I've ever said this in an AA meeting, but what the hell? I studied two things. Number one is what I studied, but they had a key to transformation. And he tried to take that and formulate it in a way that alcoholics could follow it. Well, I when I started reading the first century stuff, it was like, okay, you know, do I have to believe that Jesus walked on water? No, I don't. This is me. If you believe that, that's fine. I didn't believe it, you know, but what I learned was people were trying to say who this guy was to them, you know, and one of the Psalms was, your God will come to you walking on the waves. Now that's an internal experience of an external relationship that can't be put into words. And that allowed me then it opened the door to a religion that I had walked away from for 20 years. And I started reading about this guy, Sam Shoemaker, who was so influential with Bill Wilson. And it opened that reality for me that maybe it's not so close to me, you know? And I started going on retreats and I went to the Episcopal route. I went, you know, the Jesuits were liberal, but they weren't so liberal that they're going to accept you with a wife and three kids. You know, there's a limit to what they're going to do. You know, and I'd met a lot of Episcopalians on my journey, and so it was kind of like Catholic light. They said half the guilt. It's half the guilt was the way they would express it. So it felt like home to me, and I started doing that. Met a monk out in California at a monastery out there, Episcopal monastery. He said, "Bill, you should really be a priest. You know, you've never really lost. It's always been a part of who you are." And we kind of prayed about that, and I met him with him several times, and went to my bishop back here, and I said, "I feel called to priesthood, but not to a parish." I was, by that time, I'm running a treatment center, nonprofit treatment center here in Austin. And I said, I hope you had a good sense of humor. I said, treatment centers are sick enough. I don't know that I could do a parish. Because what do they do in a parish? They make you father, and then they pin on you all their father crap that they've never resolved, you know, and they get angrier in hell at you, and you get all of their stuff. Well, I was getting enough stuff. I didn't need any more stuff. But I said, I do feel called to work with alcoholics and addicts and try to teach them a little bit about this two-way prayer. And I just got several minutes left. So let me get to that, because that's what opened the door for me. What I discovered was that steps 10, 11, and 12, which I had been taught were maintenance steps. And in a sense, that's true. But if it's maintenance, like you're going to, go in for, every 5,000 miles and change your oil, that's not what we're talking about. What they were talking about in the Oxford group was continuance. And that was that they very quickly brought you through a transformation process where you surrendered your life, where you confessed your sins, where you began living by the four absolutes, honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love, living by these standards, But then on a daily basis, you practiced a quiet time. Nobody ever taught me about this in AA, but that's what they did. And Wilson said he thought AA lost something when they stopped practicing it so much. We started reading little meditation books, nothing wrong with that. But that's not what they were doing. What they were doing was they were listening to God. They were listening for God's voice. They were seeking guidance in their life. And they would sit there in their morning meditation. They'd do prayer, they'd do meditation, but then they would sit, take their problem to God and wait for guidance and receive guidance from God. And it might be a name of somebody to call. It might be something to do. It might be something that Mr. Hyde is showing up again in your life in some way, and you're recognizing that. And there he is in your mind, and you write that down. And then you go about the business of following the guidance, being obedient. Now, isn't that an uncharacteristic alcoholic trait? Obedient. And once I understood what this practice was, then lines in the big book started making sense to me. Wilson said he put step six, he put the four absolutes into step six and seven. Well, once I had that little key, it made sense. I understood them at a deeper level. When he says, we were new at this stuff, and we might do some foolish things in the beginning, but God takes pleasure in our willingness to find and follow his will, all those kinds of things started making sense. I read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, a marvelous book put out by AA. You want to understand the history of AA? Start with that one, And boom, it comes alive that they were working a different program than the one I had been taught. My program had become mechanical. Theirs was trying to be anything but. And so that's what I started to do. I couldn't find a lot of directions for how they did two-way prayer. Found a few things here, a few things there. They weren't big on telling you, you got to do this, you got to do that. But there it was, listening to God, foreign concept, you know, to me, foreign concept. And they used to start with a prayer. It's from 1 Samuel. I'm not a great scripture scholar, but it was speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. That's how they'd often start their prayer. And for years, I did that. Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And they liked it because their past prayers had been, listen, Lord, for your servant is speaking. It was that 180 that kind of gets the ego right-sized, rightly related. You know, sometimes I hear people in AA say, well, I got to get rid of my ego. Well, please don't do that. You know, you'll become psychotic. You know, you have to have an ego. But what is the size of your ego? Is it oversized? Is it undersized? No, it has to be right-sized. And right-sized means listening. Standing up to those voices inside that David was talking about. Those voices that take over our personalities, those sub-personalities, if you will, that exist in all of us. I found one, I call him Atlas. Atlas, who's gonna carry the world on his shoulders. That part of me that does that, you know? Hey, put the world down. That's not your job, that's God's job. Well, that was a relief. Of course, Atlas shows up again. what we have is a daily reprieve based upon our spiritual condition. So you got to keep an eye on these monkeys because they're going to appear and they'll take over. They take over your life. That's what addiction is. I didn't want to drink, but a part of me did want to drink. So I had to come to recognize that part of me that wanted to drink and talk to that part of me. I had to recognize, like you were talking about, the teenager in you who wants this, that, and the other thing. The little child in me who was trying, at 5 and 6 years old, I'm trying to be the adult in the room, you know, because my parents are crazy, you know? All of these things, if we have to go inside. The great reality is within and the work is within. And that's what this morning quiet time is about. When they did a study of early recovery, Wilson was trying to get money out of old man Rockefeller. And he sent his guy, Frank Amos, out to study. Why does this thing work? How come alcoholics are getting sober when for generations they never did? You know, the odds were awful. And they went, and this guy, Frank Amos, went and he studied it. Stories in the book, and Dr. Bob, and the good old timers. And he came back with a report of what was essential and what was not essential. And I'm often accused as being an AA heretic. I'm often accused of being a Christian heretic too. So I figure if I'm getting crap from both sides, I'm probably pretty okay. You know, kind of get down the middle there. But he came back and his thing was meetings were helpful. Listen to this. Meetings were helpful. Prayer and meditation were a must. Now, when I first read that, it was like, oh my God, nobody ever taught me this. They said prayer and meditation are a little like maintenance stuff. You know, so you kind of read, tweak, off you go. No, prayer and meditation were the essential things. And that's not to say meetings weren't helpful. They are helpful. I still go to meetings. But I'll tell you this, I do not depend on meetings. And I actually got that from my first sponsor, who said, you know, Bill, AA could disappear someday. And you know what? If it does, I'm okay. His reliance was not on AA, nor is mine. My reliance is on God. And that's where it's supposed to be put. The only safe place to put it. The only safe place, the only absolute. And if you and if you strive for that, you know, and I know I get in trouble when I say this, you know, but it's like for me, the only steps I work today are 10, 11, and 12. They're the only steps I work. For 20 years, I was doing circular AA. Oh, another inventory. Oh, another this. Back to go. No. Do it once, get through it, get to 10, 11, and 12, and live them intensely. One of the AA pioneers, I'm watching my clock now. All right, one of the AA pioneers said something that just put step 10 in perspective for me that was mind-blowing. And he said this, if you don't watch, you won't know what the hell to pray for. Light came on. Step 10 is not about being a good little boy and watching yourself. It's about being on a spiritual journey and watching where you're going astray, you know, because you will. On a daily basis, you will go astray. But if you watch it, then you know what to pray for. And so you bring that then to your prayer, you know, and then you receive guidance. So I've been doing two-way prayer for 30 years. I'm here to report I have never been yelled at for screwing up. This is a new experience for me. I used to get the crap kicked out of me, you know, wrong end of the belt. You know, that's when I recognized my father was doing something wrong. I figured I was guilty and wrong. I probably deserved the belt. But when I got the buckle, I knew something was wrong, you know. But I've never been yelled at. But it's. Are you ready now? Are you ready to go further? It's always that present moment that I am invited into that I have forgotten, and that's where God lives, and then to move into the spiritual experience, having had a spiritual experience, and I'm going to go with Wilson. I'm enough of a heretic that I'm going to do that. He wanted to change it back. I'm going to let him, you know. So at least in my life. I'm interested in spiritual experiences. I'm interested in having that connection alive between me and God, and then me and people, you know, because it has to flow out. It has to flow out, or it gets dammed up. And once it does that, it stagnates. Spirituality is a flow. It's a flow, and you got to keep the flow going. You know, and that's where 12 comes in, you know. Frank Bookman, who started the Oxford Group, he had a marvelous expression. He says, I work with constipated Christians. I love that phrase. They've lost the flow. They're locked up in church, you know, being holy, 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 and not becoming whole, with a W, whole, whole, whole. And that means embracing the darkness within, as David said so beautifully earlier, that I've got to embrace my darkness and bring that to God. And that's what makes prayer meaningful and alive, you know, and not to be beaten up for it, but to be ready to grow beyond it, you know. So I think that's probably a good time to quit. I'm so grateful for the teachers that have come along in my life and have given me this stuff. I hope I'm not screwing it up too much, you know. Maybe I am. I don't think so, though. I mean, I think what I'm putting out here is if you'll really dig into it. I mean, I love AA, and I don't want to see it destroyed. I don't want to see it become mechanical. I don't want to see it become mechanical. A woman sent me many years ago a 12-step rosary. And I said, holy Jesus, is this what we're doing now? We're going to turn the steps into a rosary. Come on. Come on. Instead of being a journey, it's becoming a machine. And now we chant back how it works. I noticed we've introduced chanting at the meetings. We go back and forth, you know. It's funny. It's human nature. But thank God for guys like Mike. Thank God for guys like Mike, who found something better and wanted to bring that out into the world. He was a blessing. He was a blessing to all of us. And I'm so glad we're doing this thing once a year. I hope it continues forever and ever, you know, so that 200 years, they say, who the hell was this Mike? Well, let me tell you about Mike and keep the stories going. So thank you all. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Thank you.